For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website. So, good morning. Thanks for coming. My name is Aishin, Nancy Easton, and as you can see, Taigen is not here today. He is in Albuquerque with my Dharma brother Kazan, practicing at his Sangha. And so I am giving the talk today, and for a while now I've been feeling like some people know me as a psychologist and everybody knows me as a Zen student, and sometimes, you know, people, you could say, you know, well, you wear two hats as a psychologist and a Zen student, but a lot of time it just really feels like the same hat. And so I'm going to talk a little bit today about some teachings from the Yogacara school, which is kind of a branch of Buddhism that's considered to be sort of consciousness only. It's a result of profound study and understanding of the relationship between the self and the environment. And we, you know, I think we tend to sometimes think of the environment as being everything out there, and then there's this one extra piece, and that's me, and I'm responding to the environment. And, you know, but yet we know intellectually in Zen or in Buddhism that, you know, everything is arising together. And what the Yogacara school, you know, studies is how that is, how we perceive things and how we translate that into knowledge. And so, you know, the title of my talk was, What Do You Know? And so I want to kind of explore the question of what is knowing using several sources of Buddhist thought. And my jumping off point for this is actually a koan that's number 19 in the Gateless Gate that many of you may already be familiar with. The koan, Ordinary Mind is the Way. And let me just read it to you. This is a narration of a famous encounter between the monk Zhaozhou and his teacher Nanchuan. Zhaozhou, you know, we think of him, we know him as sometimes later as, you know, sort of this great master. But this is when he was just a young monk studying with his teacher Nanchuan. And the case is, I always have to translate this, it's written Joshu. Zhaozhou earnestly asked Nanchuan, what is the way? And Nanchuan answered, the ordinary mind is the way. And Zhaozhou asked, well, should I direct myself toward it or not? And Nanchuan said, if you try to turn toward it, you go against it. And Zhaozhou asked, if I do not try to turn toward it, how can I know that it is the way? And Nanchuan answered, the way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is a blank consciousness. When you have really reached the true way beyond all doubt, you will find it as vast and boundless as the great empty sky. How can it be talked about on a level of right and wrong? And at these words, Zhaozhou was suddenly enlightened. So there's lots of things to take from this koan, and I think people have talked about various aspects of it, but what I really wanted to talk about today is, you know, Nanchuan's answer, that the way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. You know, knowing is a delusion, not knowing is a blank consciousness. We're kind of presented two options here. You know, when Zhaozhou is saying, well, how can I know? And Nanchuan is saying, well, knowing is wrong and not knowing doesn't capture it either. You know, it's one of those kind of Zen paradoxes. Like, if you answer, I will hit you 30 times, and if you don't answer, I'll hit you 30 times. And I think that, you know, when we see a paradox in Zen, it's always a little bit of an invitation to explore something a little bit deeper. You can't just take either one at just face value. And so that is where I think that the Yogacara understanding of how we know things, how we come to perceive and formulate and cognize and know things can be really helpful. I've been studying this book, Living Yogacara, by Tagawa Shune, and one of the very first things that they talk about in this book is, there's a couple of things I'm just going to read to you from this book, but you know, he says, according to Yogacara Buddhism, what we actually perceive are images of the things of the external world as they are transformed by our own consciousness and reflected onto our own mind. So we think that we are seeing, you know, we are seeing things out there, but the things that we are seeing are really, according to Yogacara, never quite as they appear. They're not exactly the object as it is. And he gives a little example that kind of demonstrates that there's many ways of seeing or perceiving something. There's a little poem, and it goes, "At the clapping of hands, the carp comes swimming for food. The birds fly away in fright, and a maiden comes carrying tea, Sarasawa Pond." So I'll read it again. "At the clapping of hands, the carp comes swimming for food. The birds fly away in fright, and a maiden comes carrying tea, Sarasawa Pond." So this little Japanese poem demonstrates something really essential about what we know, that each of these things, the carp and the birds and the maiden or the server, have been conditioned to perceive the clap as something different. A carp thinks, you know, I guess carp back then learned that if you clap, you're going to be giving them food. And birds, you know, they just get startled. And I guess the servers back then recognized that when somebody claps, that means they need something. So there's very distinct differences as each of these individuals perceives the same event. And this kind of points to something that I think is really essential, which is that what we think we know is very often just our interpretation. It's really almost never the external world. And you can think about this in your own life. If you think about ways that you understood things, something maybe when you were a child, and then maybe as you, you know, became an adult, you realized that something is very different from how it appeared. I think there's now I wish I remembered who it was, because it is famous. The saying about from an adolescent boy, you know, when I was in my teens, my father seemed so, you know, feeble and you know, ignorant, and then when I became an adult, I realized how much he had learned in just a few years. And really, it's just, you know, the difference between an adolescence, you know, warring with their parents or rebelling against their parents, and then recognizing later, you know, oh, there's some wisdom in these things that I felt were just being imposed on me. So we're constantly interpreting the world. We're constantly interpreting what we think is happening, and we are, you know, pretty generally without devoting some study or reflection to it, we're generally unaware of how our own feelings are being projected onto the object of our awareness. If I were to ask each of you to imagine a chair and to draw a picture of the chair and then hold it up, I think everybody would come up with a different picture of a chair. And the reason why that is that because you have had different experiences with chairs, or different, we see the world according to our own conditioning, which is a lot of times a function of our experience. It can also be a function of our imagination. I think I once heard a long, long time ago that people, we tend to imagine, we like to imagine aliens from outer space, you know, and what they would look like. And we always seem to imagine them as like, you know, humanoid kind of things with two eyes and a mouth and you know, some kind of carbon-based life form, even if it's not fully a, you know, humanoid object. And that is because we're actually largely incapable, for the most part, of imagining things beyond what we kind of know. And so this is sort of an essential Yogacara approach to understanding the relationship between ourselves and our environment. And we can really, that we are being constantly conditioned by our experience. And we really can only change this pattern through deep reflection and seeing, you know, really examining, what goes into our perceptions. You know, we have in the Heart Sutra, we talk about sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. And we can, in Zazen in particular, which I'll get into more in a little bit, really start to sort of pay attention to that and pick it apart and begin to see that some of the things that we think we're perceiving are actually illusions. But the Yogacara school goes on to say that furthermore, we not only transform what we're perceiving based on our conditioning, but we tend to do it in a way that provides the greatest convenience for us. So in other words, we tend to transform the world, or we tend to transform what we're perceiving or experiencing in such a way that it matches what we think we already know, or, you know, thus making us right. Or we tend to perceive things in such a way that we create ourselves as a continual protagonist in our own drama, that these things are happening to me. And we don't always, it's very hard to step outside of something and gain objectivity. I think it's actually impossible, but I think we can get a little closer through study. So, you maybe have someone, and I can think of, somebody in my life that, maybe I'm not getting along with. We're arguing, and you can think to yourself, okay, so maybe they're my friend, or maybe they're not my friend, or maybe their actions are consistent with their idea of friendship, even though they're not consistent with my idea of friendship. Or maybe I've done something that's not consistent with their idea of friendship. And, the possibilities are endless. And so, I think it might sometimes be more accurate to say that something appears to be, we appear to be not getting along, or, that person appears to be my friend. And because we never quite see anything actually the way it is. We may see what we expect to see, or we might see what we both expect and fear to see, but never beyond our own limitations at the moment. And actually, there's a line from Genjo Kaon, from Dogen, that... What did I do with it? Here it is. Okay. It's on my back page. So he says, though there are many features in the dusty world and the world beyond conditions, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. And I've always liked this line because it suggests to me that through practice, we can see a little bit more. I'll get into that a little bit more when I talk more specifically about Zazen. But what I also want to take from it is that, therefore, we're always kind of determining the environment that appears to be influencing us, that really, everything is arising together. Our environment is arising along with our perceptions, but we've kind of created the parameters for the environment that can arise, because we're only able to see what our experience has told us is happening, or what our experience has told us to fear is happening. So, does that make sense? I will break it down a little in a little different way, more specifically from some of the thinking of the Yogacara school and what they and one of the things that we learn through learning a little bit more about Yogacara Buddhism is that we have sort of six consciousnesses that are comprising what they call the surface of the mind, the immediate part of the mind. And those would be, as you might expect, you know, visual consciousness, which we are things we can perceive with our eye, and the object for that would be sight, or the function of that would be sight. The object would be, you know, something that we see. We have auditory consciousness, which is being perceived, taken in by our ear. Olfactory consciousness, things that come through our nose. Gustatory, through our mouth. Tactile or body consciousness is things that we can experience through touch or sort of kinesthetic sense. And then this, and so these all, you know, we're all familiar with, we're all familiar with the five senses, but in Buddhism we have one more, which is thinking, which is the mind and the experience, the function that is perceived through the mind is kind of the object of mind. Our mind is continually drawn to different objects. And actually, the first five, you know, the things that we think of as our five senses are called the prior five consciousnesses. And they are really only able to cognize presently existing objects. It's, you know, the minute you see something, that your visual consciousness is grasping onto it and cognizing it. The minute you have a word for what it is that you're seeing, that's when you've engaged actually the sixth consciousness that has some kind of word to apply for it. So apply to it. This is, you know, requiring your mind to sort of interpret things before you really even have words to describe that. The thinking consciousness can hold objects in memory, and it also can contain, you know, a lot of experience, years of experience, our whole experience, which then points to some deeper layers of the mind, because we're not just constantly, you know, seeing and categorizing, we're also developing, we're seeing and categorizing, but that's not completely separable from making some meaning or deriving some meaning from what it is that we think we see. So let me read to you a little bit on... Okay, so, yeah, just to illustrate, they talk about recollecting the past, anticipating the future, or carrying out a variety of calculations and comparisons, and then gathering and synthesizing all of these. These are the functions of the thinking consciousness. So the thinking consciousness is able to access a little bit of what's in the past or what, you know, what we think might be in the future, and then is taking that and applying it to the object that we are perceiving. It's not really storing things, it's just sort of a processing center. The deeper layers of the mind are two in particular are the things that create this sort of ongoing narrative, and the first one is called the manas, M-A-N-A-S, which is an area of the mind that basically contains, is thought to contain, the eye-making function, that it creates this idea of a self that has carried on from the experiences of the past into the present, and that we tend to cling to. We use it as a way of kind of organizing these perceptions into, you know, this is something in my experience that's happened to me. And then the second one would be the Alaya Vijnana, which is called the storehouse consciousness. And this actually, although it's not the same as the unifying self, it's really an uninterrupted area deep in the mind that retains our actions and experiences. It retains them all. And it's just an aspect of function where, or just an aspect of consciousness where everything is, you know, kind of stored and available for our, you know, brains to compare it to and then make sense of it. So the thinking mind level, I think, is just making sense of all these perceptions and then our experience and putting it together. And this is where we, this is why we are not perceiving things directly and just as they actually are. These eight consciousnesses sort of comprise our mind as a subjective transformer. We can't really step too far outside of our experiences. It's very difficult to, you know, modify anything in that store of experience because you can't really undo something that you've done. You can't unsee something that you have seen. It's very hard to pull apart, something that has been an experience as you know it. You know, I mean, it kind of leaves you with nothing if you have nothing else to go on. So, you know, this can lead to really profound difficulties in knowing any given current experience or thing as it really is. I was reminded of this when I was in grad school and I was writing a paper in psychology. I was writing a paper about the effects of childhood bullying on adults, adult behavior, adult relationships, and in writing this paper, I was recalling how, you know, I had been also bullied when I was young, and so this is part of why I had this interest in writing this paper, and had found myself in this research, just noticing that, you know, that the problems that I had in my 20s, you know, in entering into different kinds of friendships and relationships, and my bafflement when I could see that people around me weren't struggling with the same things, you know, that they didn't seem to have the same difficulties doing this. And it was a big realization for me to recognize that people who didn't have that experience weren't expecting that, you know, some of the things that I had experienced to happen. And so that was a big turning point for me. But what was an even bigger turning point was realizing that everybody has their own set of experiences that have taught them things about the world, and everyone is, you know, responding to what they think, what you all, or what, you know, everyone you know, everyone here, everyone we don't know, walking around with some scar tissue based on some past training of, you know, oh, this is going to hurt you. And so everyone is walking around with, you know, their own things about this is where you will find danger in the world or in the world of people. And for the most part, none of us know what anybody else's is because it's not happening right now. We can't see it and we can't, you know, gauge it. And so, you know, it just was such a reminder that, you know, we all have past conditioning. Everybody's past conditioning is a little bit different. Some people's past conditioning make it very easy for them to, you know, do some things with ease, and some people's past conditioning make them, you know, a little more hesitant about other things. But we all have this, you know, this scar tissue that no one else sees, and that is continually impacting, you know, any interaction. You know, if I'm interacting with you, I think one thing is happening and you might think that something very different is happening. I may think, oh, well, we're friends, and you may think, well, if we were friends, you wouldn't be doing that, you know? So, you know, clearly it's not possible to fully know anything given, you know, the years of different experiences that we've all had. So that's one aspect. But, you know, can we say, you know, can we just say then, okay, well then, you know, knowing obviously is a delusion, as they, you know, say in the koan. Can we just say, you know, okay, well then we don't know. You know, Sung San, the Korean monk who was founded the Providence Zen Center, would say, you know, only don't know. You know, and you know, within our lineage, we have beginner's mind, you know, Zen mind is beginner's mind. And in the mind of a beginner, there's lots of possibilities you can't really know. And, you know, even in some of our Zen stories, the story of the sixth patriarch, you know, there was the alleged poetry contest where monks had to demonstrate their understanding. And one of the monks said, you know, since fundamentally nothing exists, where can dust alight? You know, that these things are true. You know, we can't really fully know everything. We have to kind of not know. But we don't want to, you know, over-identify with, you know, kind of nothing is really knowable. That's maybe a little bit of an over-identification with the absolute or the universal. And we still have to live in the phenomenal world. You know, there's a book by Katagiri Roshi, the title of which is "You Have to Say Something." And we do, you know, because otherwise nothing would happen. We can't just continue to not know. And in fact, our ancestors also did not just not know, because, you know, if you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, you cannot just sort of say, okay, well, perhaps they have eaten my ancestors, but, you know, maybe this one will be different. We have to kind of generalize, you know, and that's, I think, the real difficulty for all of us, is that even though we can't fully know things, we can't just stay in not knowing. You know, we have to do things to live in the world, and we have to take care of it, and we have to care about what happens. And unfortunately, you know, maybe fortunately, I think that's maybe just sometimes my sort of thing. Unfortunately, we can't do it perfectly, you know, but there's my conditioning. You know, I want everything to be sort of orderly and perfect, and it just cannot be. So how can we find a way through this? You probably have some ideas already about how we can find a way through it, but I'm going to read... where are we? Okay, I'm going to read a little bit more of Dogen in Genjo Koan. There's one paragraph, I think, that really exemplifies this the most for me. It says, "When Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. For example, when you sail out in a boat to the midst of an ocean where no land is in sight and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular and does not look any other way," right? Is there anybody who's never been in a boat? So things look very different when you're in a boat and the water looks kind of round. So, but the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. And then my favorite sentence: "Though there are many features in the dusty world and the world beyond conditions, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. In order to learn the nature of the myriad things, you must know that although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there. It is so not only around you, but also directly beneath your feet or in a drop of water." So as you sit in a boat and you watch a distant horizon come into view, you can see that it's not just, you know, sort of a black speck on out there, but it, you know, at first maybe it looks like kind of just a big mass, and then as you get closer, you can see that some parts are jutting out and some have trees and some, you know, have a little bit more beach. And so I think this is a nice metaphor for Zazen, because as we sit with something and we just let it, you know, it's not like we have to go looking for stuff to sort of reflect on. It's stuff just comes to us, and we sit and we sit with it, and we gain maybe a little bit more of a felt sense of it, or we understand a different aspect of it, or we think about a line from something that reminds us of it, and we get to where we can actually make a better map. And so I think of Zazen as something that gives us A different kind of knowledge, actually, more of an experiential knowledge. I remember when I was in college, I took German, and I was surprised to learn that in German they have two words for knowing: Wissen, which is like intellectual knowing, and Kennen, which is more experiential knowing. And there's that famous Goethe poem, "Kennst du das Land?" Which is, you know, do you know the land? But it's like, do you know the land because you have, you know, been to the land and lived in the land and experienced the land? And so Zazen, I think, can, in just sitting and letting things arise and, you know, not holding on to them, not trying to, you know, sit and reflect on them, but just letting them arise and be, I think it really gives us much more of that sort of experiential knowledge of something, how it feels over time, or, you know, over time, maybe a different observation of what it is, you know, just because we're observing it. So, you know, in this passage from Dogen, I think he's kind of saying, you know, before practice or study, things look one way because we are different. We're not because we're different, because we have some distance from them and some difference from them. But because of practice and study, during practice and then, you know, even when we're not on our cushions, we find ourselves becoming intimate or familiar with greater dimensions of anything, you know, of our lives or of our relationships or our experiences or these things that seem to be out there. And for better or worse, I think none of these are the objective truth, because we never can get to that, but we can, you know, kind of get a little bit more in the center of many subjective truths that, you know, it's not just me, the subject, and you all as the objects. You all are actually subjects, and in getting a little bit more, you know, intimate and familiar with ourselves, we can, you know, get a little bit more familiar with the feelings and thoughts of others. We can maybe open up a little bit more to others' experience. We can, you know, recognize that all of the things that are happening to us are happening in a context that's partly determined by us and partly determined by lots of things. So, you know, much more so than, you know, the idea of knowing something or not knowing something. It's kind of a partial and ongoing, you know, experiencing and opening to knowing. So I think that's maybe all I wanted to say today. I'm hoping we can have a little bit of a conversation for a moment about knowing and not knowing, and really anything anybody wants to know or tell. I think that that's, you know, kind of the nice thing about a Dharma discussion as well, is that there's, you know, amongst us, we're all experts in different things, and so we all can kind of, you know, bring forth something or learn something together. We don't all have to go figure out, you know, okay, what's this? We can sort of bring it forth. So if anyone would like to offer a comment. Joan, thanks.
Thank you for that talk. What it brought to mind for me is I'm part of a group that's starting a local affiliate of a national organization. There's just four of us trying to organize some workshops and so on. But the problem is, two of the people, I'm lucky that no one is really setting me off in any particular way, but two of the people set each other off. And so I'm trying to figure out, you know, how do I kind of, in a sense, stand between them, sort of kind of buffer whatever it is. I don't know what it is in each of their histories that makes them react.
Yeah.
But it's very much they're seeing something or hearing something different from what I see and hear from them. And just how can I buffer that enough so that we can work together? I just have to keep in mind I don't know what that history is.
Yeah, Do they ever talk with you about what they, the difficulties they have with each other, or that might not be appropriate? That, that, you know, is always not always appropriate in different contexts, but.
Well, they've kind of acknowledged those reactions to each other.
Do they acknowledge it to each other?
I think they have, yeah. Okay. I guess they kind of snap at each other.
That's so hard. Is it, it makes me wonder if it's something that might be, you know, still evolving for each of them, you know. Sometimes people gain a sense of like, okay, I gotta find a better way of working with this person.
I hope
on their own, yeah.
I hope that they'll, you know, that they'll be able to do that and say, well, look, they're just four of us and we're working together.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know even in Zazen, you know, we may come through one period of Zazen feeling just as fixed about, you know, something that we don't like, and it takes some time to, you know, kind of work through it. But, you know, I wonder if there may be people who are, you know, they may be a little bit more open to doing that than others.
Yeah, well, you're giving me a thought that it might pay for me to talk a little more individually with each of them, so that I might ease the way.
And maybe help each of them recognize what they're bringing to it. They can't really know what the other person is bringing to it.
Mm-hmm.
Or just have a context of recognizing that, you know, we're all bringing different painful experiences. Okay. So it sounds like each of them has somehow, you know, tripped up somebody's painful place.
I think so.
as we do. It reminds me of kind of, you know, what Teigen says about the rock tumbler metaphor, that we're all kind of hopefully as a sangha, you know, in practicing together, just tumbling around against each other and rubbing down our rough edges so that they're smoothed. And this is one of the ways in which we do that is some, you know, sometimes by talking, but sometimes too by just reflecting on ourselves.
Yeah. Thank you.
I don't know if anybody else has ideas from your own experience about that. But.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We've all had that kind of experience.
But there's somebody at work, and the two of us just, it's like, and what it's doing for me is saying, I have to take a look about me. I can't look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have to see, and my being open, yeah, and being able to see a situation differently.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's a matter of, first of all, awareness and knowing what's going on, and then the chance to see, okay, what is my part in it?
Mm-hmm.
And let it come up, and then how can I change this? I think of it, you know, like if we see ourselves suffer, you know, we think about, and then taking this from the Zen perspective, as we see ourselves suffer, and it's interesting because when you talk, I'm very conscious of this, that we, for a different reason, but we always talk about the environment like it's something outside of us, and really we are part of it. It's our environment. We're in it.
Yeah.
We're participating in it. We're relating to it. You know, I come from the point of view of someone who's concerned about our environment, what's happening to it. So my biggest push for people to create that awareness is to let them see it's our environment, not the environment separate from us. And anytime I do that, like I'm doing this with this guy, Tim, who we're interacting at work, I've created a separateness in this way. How can we find this? How can I find the sameness? How can I find the common thread rather than the different threads?
Okay.
And I don't know if that'll be helpful, because if they can find the common threads rather than the different threads,
yeah,
combine them.
You're also making me think of how, you know, in some contexts, that kind of communication, for whatever reason, is just not possible, or, you know, maybe it's not appropriate for that context. And when I find myself in that kind of dilemma, I try to just be as kind as possible, You know, like, I feel like that's a good guideline for anybody, is we don't know what, you know, what's happening with somebody else. And so, you know, to just be as kind as you can and in your own estimation of the other person, as well as in your own behavior towards that person, sometimes can really change, you know, the dynamic without ever really knowing what was going on between, you know, yourself and somebody else.
I
thought so, Ken.
Yeah. So a couple, just a comment, then I had a question.
Yeah, sure.
So when I was listening to your what you were saying, something came to mind, and it was when I would do Dokusan with Tenshin Reb Roshi, a lot of times whenever I would tell him something about that was personal and heated for me or a conflict, a lot of times he would offer, well, that's a nice story. And I was thinking about the Yogacara concept, that like there's this knowing that I'm hearing I'm having knowing through your perception, through you telling me, through your knowing, that says that there's a conflict.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know that there's a conflict,
right?
You're saying that maybe there's a pain, or maybe this is how the people communicate. Like, sometimes I'm somewhat animated in the way I communicate, and it can look like I'm in conflict, and I may actually have a different feeling.
Right.
So I think, and I've actually been having a struggle with a dear friend of mine who, I'm like, I feel like we're in conflict, and I haven't said anything, and so I'm trying to feel it out first, because I don't know if we're in conflict.
Yeah, right. And asking the person may not elicit an answer that's really helpful to you at all.
Because the moment I open my mouth, I'm dualistic, right? So even the word conflict is wrong, right?
Yeah.
It's not like, or what is going on? Tell me about what is going on. The moment he opens his mouth, he would be dualistic. So it would, like, I'm trying to practice, like, Kien-Hien with it right now, and really just be very observant about it and very present for it, and settling down some of the story making, some of the six skanda, and like just really experiencing the five others.
Yeah.
And that's very hard, of course.
Yeah, right. Well, that's where reminding yourself that something appears to be something can be really helpful, I think.
Yes, and so when I'm able to do that, it takes away some of the heat, right? Oh, well, that's interesting. Like, it's like a knee pain when I'm practicing Zazen. It's like, oh, what is that? Versus, oh my God, my knee's going to fall. Right? And both are thoughts.
Right.
And so the what is it, the inquisitive mind, the beginner's mind, can be very helpful.
Yeah.
In those situations.
Helpful, and help you kind of study something to stay open to the possibilities.
Yeah, and I think that segues into my question, which is kind of like, so I struggle a lot with kind of falling off into either, you know, this like conventional versus ultimate, off over to nihilism, over to conventional, you know, kind of back and forth.
Yeah.
And so I feel like one of the challenges I have with like the Yogacara concepts is, and especially with your psychology background, is denial, right? So there's not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel like my near enemy for that is denial. Mm-hmm. So for example, my friend that I think I'm in conflict with right now, oh, well, I don't know, not knowing. Mm-hmm. Am I in denial, or is it conflict? I have some hotter examples, but I mean, that's an easy Sangha level example.
It sounds like denial feels like something that you don't want to be in. And, you know, I think we get a lot of pressure in our culture to, like, don't be in denial. You should be knowing these things. You know, you should be aware. But I think what's hard is to really gain a sense of what is it that I'm aware of. And it sounds like you have some hunches, you know, and so you can, maybe one thing that would help would be to try to check out some of the hunches. Find a way to, even if you can't necessarily talk with the person, see if you have a hunch that something really sets that person off. See if you can find a way to not do that, and see if they, you know, their inflammation goes down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's really, you know, it's really I don't know what to say exactly about denial, but I think there's a way in which you're working with it. You know, you're working with it. You don't have the an outcome that feels satisfactory to you yet, but you have an awareness that you're working with it. And I know what you mean, that we can substitute, you know, that the idea that we're working through something for denial, but it sounds like you're still working with it anyway.
I think I hear you saying that maybe denial is actually an aversion. It's like I put it in a box and I call it that's not
that's
it.
Good. Yeah, okay.
Whereas maybe Zen non-denial or the opposite of denial from a Zen perspective might be rather than labeling it, because I feel like especially in traditional American psychology, like there's this kind of like temptation to label it and create, you know, like,
yeah,
I'm an addict,
yeah,
or I am one of this,
yeah,
or I am that.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's interesting, but maybe not. Maybe that once I label it, then I lose the Zen opportunity of exploration.
Right. Or and then you feel like, I better get away from that, so I better not be in denial.
Yes.
And yet I don't know that, I mean, I think we're constantly waking up to something, and so we're always in a little bit of denial, but we're always a little bit awake. Maybe just taking the label of badness off of it.
Right.
you kind of have to just trust in your own intention, maybe, to be trying to figure it out too, or trying to understand.
I appreciate your talk. It stirred up all kinds of things for me as you were talking, and just as, before I, you know, one thing that in responding to your conversations is, you know, like sometimes getting, you know, when you think you're in conflict or you feel tension and you don't know what to do with it, sometimes backing up a little to look for what are the overarching things that we know we agree on, you know, like what are the things that we know we can rally around and try to back up and focus on those, whether it's a group setting or like I've had conflict or, you know, tension with a good friend that I've traveled with, and it's like I had to back up and think, okay, where are we good? Where do I know we're good? You know, it's like, okay, that's, you know, that's the foundation, and just to kind of get to that is helpful sometimes.
It's actually kind of similar to, you know, a physical process that happens in all of us when we're maybe if you have a something like I've been dealing with a lot of aches and pains from starting running, and one of the things I've been learning is you actually have to get the inflammation to calm down before you can really, you know, work with things or heal them, and that's where, like what you're saying, finding some common ground, finding some way of interacting with somebody where it isn't continually getting inflamed all over again. Sometimes then also does lead to a place where people can, you know, kind of back down and say, oh, okay, wow, you know, I've had some good interactions with you, and maybe that can continue. But yeah, finding a common ground is a good one.
Yeah, and then, you know, thinking about this in terms of Zazen, you know, it's like, I think I struggle with Zazen sometimes in that it, you know, it does make you aware of how subjective our own experience is. It brings you closer to that. But sometimes it feels self-involved, or, you know, it's like it's removing you from the rest of the world, or I don't know. It's like how to delve into that but not get caught away in, I don't know, reveling and understanding yourself or getting closer, or I'm not saying this accurately, but there's something about that that's, I think, part of the struggle for me is you're getting more in touch with yourself, but it's also still your impression of how things are. And you have to check that in some way. You know, you have to remember that you have to keep checking that out.
Yeah, that it's very just your impressions and maybe very dependent on the context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is really no objective way to, you know, to be fully objective. But you can look at, you know, so what is the function of this on my relationships with others or my ability to you know, do the things in life that I've intended to do.
Right.
Is it drawing me away from or to a place where I become more intolerant with others, or is it helping me to, you know, open up and become a little bit more
conscious,
flexible?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay. I guess we're kind of running over, but maybe there's one more question.
I'm looking at all this from a Zen context, and what I'm thinking of is how it's like we all want to know, and in a sense, it's just like the koan we talked about. That's knowing is a delusion.
Yeah.
And I think what is the hardest thing for us as people is to know that we don't know. And stay with that.
Yeah.
It's like we want to know. We want to put it, is it denial or is it something else? And we want to categorize it. And we just sometimes sit with something and not know. Mm-hmm. And I think what's hard for me in Zen, some of the koans, is that they don't make sense. It's paradoxical.
They don't make sense?
and so I just have to sit with that not knowing for a while.
And not get paralyzed by it. Not just say, okay, that's it, you can't know. So
Yeah, not be paralyzed. Just sit with it. And just sit with it. And then out of nothingness something will arise.
Yeah.
And that's the hard part, is being able to sit with not knowing.
Yeah.
Because
stuff arises and it's a really inefficient process, but it seems to be all we have.
Yeah, but also, by not knowing, I'm not separating myself. Again, it's that concept of separation, that we're all interdependent. If I put something on it, put a label on it, and I'm over here, and it's over here, rather than just saying, I don't know, and I'm not separate.
Yeah.
Or I'm not, it's not that I'm separate, I'm always myself. I'm always me.
Yeah.
But I'm now integrated with all that's around me, rather than separate from all that's around me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In that sense. So it's tough. It's not all, you know.
It is tough. No, and I mean, that would be the ideal, and yet we all wind up, you know, spending a little bit of time in each place, thinking we know or thinking we don't know, or, you know, trying to sort that out, wondering if we're in denial. We all spend time in each of these places along the way.
Yeah, and I think what we have a tendency to do is all try to jump into one spot instead of just...
thinking that one spot is better than another.
Right. So.
Thanks.